So without further ado, as they say, I'd like to introduce Bridget. I know she's very well known to most of you, and I will just read her little short blurb, but of course there's a lot more to her capacity and CV than is talked about here. So of course she's a bioethicist and researcher with CCBI at the University of St Michael's College. She's a former Associate Dean of Studies at Sacred Heart in Peterborough. And she worked beforehand as a clinical ethicist in hospitals in Toronto. And she continues to practice as a healthcare ethics consultant. She researches, writes, and lectures about issues in bioethics. And her current issues include social justice and healthcare, particularly the social determinants of health. And some of you were at the session that we co-sponsored again with the Knights of Malta, and Bridget was one of the keynote speakers. So, and also the effects of these social determinants on the well-being of individuals and communities. And Dr. Campion has four children, a couple of them who are here tonight, and lives in Coburg. So please help me welcome Bridget.
Thank you very much, Moira. Okay, and I'm going to ask that absurd question. Can you all hear me? Is there anybody who can't hear me? That's the kicker.
It's not as clear as I would like it.
Yeah, okay. let me just try and figure this out.
I'd like to move down to the front, please. Some of us can move to the back.
Okay, well, what I'll do is I'll stand here. How's that?
That's better.
Okay, and it means that things will be a little bit messy. Not as good for filming. And, of course, as I said to Moira, you know, we're dealing with Catholics. They'll all be at the back of the room, right?
I'm bashful, but I'm also deaf.
Well, okay, I'm glad to have you up here. So that's a very good thing. And if my voice starts to trail off a bit, just put your hand up and I'll try to pump it back up. And, of course, I see that there's people still wearing green, and here on the 18th of March, we find ourselves positioned between two what I think of as major feast days, you know, the Feast of St. Patrick and, of course, the Feast of St. Joseph. And I don't know about you, but at our household, we considered these days of papal dispensation during the Lenten season. It was good to have them. At any rate, it is a pleasure to be here this evening to be talking to you about building a culture of life in the shadow of death. And this topic is prompted by the recent Supreme Court of Canada decision to legalize physician-assisted suicide in Canada. Now, although the ruling calls the intervention physician-assisted death, I do think that physician-assisted suicide is a more accurate description of the procedure. Like euthanasia, the death of the patient in physician-assisted suicide is the intended outcome of the intervention. And like euthanasia, it is an act that is done at the request of or with the consent of the patient. But whereas euthanasia has the physician performing the act that will kill the patient, that is providing a lethal injection, for instance, physician-assisted suicide it has the physician deliberately providing the means that the patient will then use to kill herself. So it is a suicide in that sense. And it is this form of what I call medically induced death that has been legalized. Now, over the next year, legislators will be charged with writing laws to govern physician-assisted suicide. And at this time, the Canadian Catholic Bioethics Institute, particularly Dr. Moira McQueen, has been working with organizations like the Toronto Catholic Doctors Guild, the Catholic Civil Rights League, and the Thomas More Lawyers Guild to work to ensure that conscience clauses will be recognized by professional governing bodies. Ensuring that healthcare professionals will have the right to refuse to participate in treatments that go against their conscience and the right to refuse to make referrals that would enable procedures that violate their conscience to go forward. In the meantime, legislators will be working to put what they think of as safeguards in place, limiting physician-assisted suicide to patients who are competent and who are experiencing irremediable, intractable suffering. Now, I imagine that a great deal of time will be spent coming to an agreement about the definition of terms such as intractable suffering. What does this mean exactly? But the reality is that physician-assisted suicide will become part of the Canadian medical landscape. And my belief is that almost immediately after legislation is passed allowing it, we will begin to see these so-called safeguards that were so carefully put into place begin to crumble. As people lobby to have medically induced death available to patients unable to consent to treatment, it may begin with patients who have expressed a wish for medically induced death while they were competent, either in a living will, for instance, or as an expressed, and I would hope verifiable, instruction to their designated substitute decision makers. I believe it will then move on to patients who were never in a position to express a wish one way or the other, children, for instance, or persons with profound physical and intellectual disabilities, patients whom their caregivers may judge to be in intractable pain. And given the logic, the so-called logic, behind physician-assisted suicide, it would be a violation of the rights of these patients if medically induced death were denied them, even as the choice is actively and entirely in the hands of their substitute decision makers. And once we move to medically induced death without consent, we are no longer in the realm of physician-assisted suicide. We are in the realm of what is often termed mercy killing. Now, I do not usually invoke slippery slope arguments, and it could be that my imagination is simply too limited, but I cannot see how legislated limits on physician-assisted suicide will ever hold. With the Supreme Court ruling, Pandora's box has been opened, the contents released, and there will be no going back. Which can sound very bleak to those of us who believe that health care should be about healing, curing when possible, caring and supporting always, and certainly not about killing patients. But falling into moral paralysis and despair is a temptation, and it is a temptation that must be resisted. So the question is it possible to build a culture of life when we are living in the shadow of medically induced death? And my answer is, yes, it is. But to understand how to do this, we have to examine what lies behind the demand for physician-assisted suicide. And to do that, it is best to begin at the beginning, and that is with Janet Adkins. Is the name Janet Adkins familiar to anyone here? Well, let me tell you about her. This is a description of her. Janet Adkins, an accomplished musician, teacher, mountain climber, lover of literature, mother of three, and grandmother of three, was 54. She was described by family and friends as gutsy, independent, someone possessed with a zest for life and who tried to live it to the fullest. After her children were grown, she took up hang gliding, rode in a hot air balloon, trekked the mountains of Nepal, and climbed Mount Hood. She taught music at home and English at a community college. At 53, she was diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease, and when she was about 54, she contacted Jack Kevorkian and was the first person to use his suicide machine. This was in June of 1990. Now the question, of course, is, why did she do it? And the New York Times of Wednesday, June 6, 1990, contains an excerpt from her note. She said, "I decided for the following reasons to take my own life. This is a decision taken in a normal state of mind and is fully considered. I have Alzheimer's disease and I do not want to let it progress any further. I do not want to put my family or myself through the agony of this terrible disease." The agony of the disease. Here we have an independent individual, a person who clearly valued her independence. And with Alzheimer's, she was, in her mind, facing a loss of independence. She would end up becoming dependent on others for her care. And for many people, this can be seen as a fate worse than death. First being dependent on one's family for care, and then as the disease progresses, being placed in a nursing home. And for someone who is able-bodied and able-minded, the thought of living out one's final days in a nursing home can be a terrifying prospect. So my question to you is, how many of you have ever been in a nursing home?
Visiting, working,
okay, right? What was it like?
Some of them are horrible.
In what way?
Almost degrading to people.
Okay, so what you're saying is that some of them can be very difficult places, degrading to people. Okay, other thoughts about nursing homes, other experiences of your visits?
In some situations, it's a lifesaver. If family has been neglecting and or certainly not able to care, although their intentions are good,
yes,
they come and they do quite well.
That's right. So a nursing home can be a place that can be a lifesaver for some individuals, particularly if they are coming from a place of neglect. Okay.
And they're hip.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
Yeah. In South America, when I'm a physician working here, but I've got a lot of family. In many countries, actually, the nursing homes are really not many. Most patients, even terminal stage, remain with the family because the families are more extensive. And even hiring a private duty nurse can be affordable for even low-middle-class families.
So that what you are saying to us is that there are cultures outside of North America where nursing homes are very few and far between because of the existence of the extended family. And this is where the care of infirm individuals take place. Even hiring nursing staff can be affordable for many families. So this can be an alternative. Well, let me ask a different question, okay? Because there are different experiences. As you say, this can be a life-giving place. It can be a very difficult place. Would you like to be a resident in a nursing home?
You're saying, are we looking forward to being a resident in a nursing home?
Well, yes. Is this something that you would look forward to? And you're saying it would depend.
It depends on what nursing home you go to.
It depends on what nursing home you go to. Okay. Yeah.
Also depends on the family.
And it depends on the family. Okay. And as we say, there can be differences in nursing homes. What I hear, though, and I have to tell you, I have worked in long-term care settings as an ethicist. I've worked in special care units. I've worked in freestanding long-term care units and long-term care attached to hospitals and so on. And what I found is that, first of all, not everybody can work in a long-term care institution. Okay? It can be a very difficult place for people. And when we ourselves think about our futures, it normally isn't that. But many people live in long-term care institutions, and many of us will end up there as well. Okay? And when we're talking about nursing homes and long-term care institutions, what we're talking about are residential facilities for people who are unable to take care of themselves and who need more support and supervision than is available to them in their homes or can be made available to them through the community. And to be eligible to reside in a long-term care home, a person must, among other things, require 24-hour nursing and personal care, frequent assistance with the tasks of daily living, and by those I mean bathing, toileting, getting dressed, and also require on-site supervision and monitoring in order to preserve their safety and well-being. Currently in Ontario, there are 629 long-term care homes providing accommodation for more than 76,000 residents. This is according to the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care. And according to the report Living Longer, Living Well, in 2012 there were nearly 20,000 people on wait lists. I come from Coburg. Our total population is 18,000 people, well, depending which side you read. So we are talking about a sizable population. And of course we have an aging population, and current estimates are that by the year 2035, 238,000 people will need long-term care in Ontario. Those are the numbers. It is important to note that the care needs of nursing home residents have changed, becoming progressively heavier and more complex. According to the report, Living Longer, Living Well, and I quote, currently 85% of the new admissions coming from the community and 78% of the admissions coming from hospitals are in the high level 4 or very high level 5 clinical needs category. Furthermore, according to the Canadian Institute for Health Information, in Ontario, 3/4 of its long-term care residents are either totally dependent or require extensive assistance with their activities of daily living. Just over 3/4 are cognitively impaired, while 1/3 have responsive behaviors, and over 1/2 show signs of health instability. That the care needs of long-term care residents are becoming increasingly heavy and complex is a trend that is likely to continue, so much so that, and again I quote, the sector predicts that virtually all of those admitted to long-term care homes in the future will soon be from the 2 highest needs categories. We are moving from long-term care homes to long-term care hospitals. There is a shift taking place. And the thing to remember is that unlike the patient population moving through acute care facilities, residents of long-term care homes are not going to get better. They are not going to be cured. As the report Living Longer, Living Well notes, in long-term care, 97% of beds are long-stay beds as opposed to respite or convalescent beds, and they serve, as I quote, as a final destination for many older Ontarians. And I believe that we must examine long-term care, this particular sector of our healthcare system, if we are to understand the fundamental basis for the demand for medically induced death. If we allow ourselves to think about it, for many, many, many of us, the thought of living out our final days in a long-term care facility generates a great deal of fear. And you hear it. Faced with being neglected while being totally dependent on others for care, having priority given to tasks and schedules rather than one's own needs, being confined to a bed or a chair without stimulation or meaningful companionship, you hear people say that they would rather be put out of their misery, they would rather be dead than be placed in a long-term care facility. Long-term care, as far as I'm concerned, is ground zero. This is the sector that we have to examine if we must, in order to understand what may be required to provide life-giving and life-preserving alternatives to the demand for medically induced death, because it is here that we find a most vulnerable patient population. And it is also here that we have a very vulnerable workforce, and those are the personal support workers. Both the patient population and the workforce are devalued in our healthcare system, and this has devastating consequences for both. Now, I take it most people are familiar with the term personal support worker. Okay, so these are direct caregivers who help people with daily personal care needs. They do for patients what the patients can no longer do for themselves because of their physical and or cognitive impairments. PSWs are in many ways a marginalized workforce. They are unregulated. There is no single training program for PSWs, although this may be changing. In the hierarchy of healthcare professions, PSWs occupy the bottom rung. They are not supposed to be independent thinkers, but are rather directed in their work by RNs and RPNs and management. And the work they do, providing personal care, is not considered to be skilled work. They are perhaps the most poorly paid of the direct caregivers, and many positions are part-time only, meaning that PSWs have no job security, many PSWs have no job security or benefits. It is also a group that is particularly vulnerable to workplace exploitation, its members being overwhelmingly women of color, many of whom are immigrants. They are in a precarious position. And it is the PSWs who provide the majority of care for residents in long-term care. And the single biggest challenge for PSWs is workload. I have the words of one PSW, and she was just describing what her morning is like. And during her regular morning routine, she cares for 9 patients before breakfast. It is a process that involves waking them, helping them rise, shower, dress, and take their medication. Then she immediately moves on to a new task. By 8:30, she says, "I'm in the dining room to do a waitress job for 28 to 30 individuals. Since some staff members are on break, there are only 2 or 3 on the floor at this time. It's a juggling act because as they're serving, they are required to input the food that they've been serving into the residents' computer files, and they may need to drop everything to respond to a call if a patient needs assistance. There's no time for conversations with the patients and barely any time to communicate with the co-workers. Although there may be individual exceptions, most long-term care centers are best described as assembly lines, as staff try to balance too many responsibilities and care for too many patients without adequate support. The result is that patients' needs are compromised. A lot of them feel neglected, rejected, and very angry because you're always in a hurry," says Palmer. There is no legislated residence to PSW ratio that must be met in long-term care facilities. One estimate is that the sector average is somewhere between 11 to 13 residents per PSW, but there simply aren't any sector standards here. And the unregulated and, I believe, unrealistic workload has consequences for both residents and staff. Consider something as basic as toileting. If a resident has mobility issues or dementia, toileting can be very time-consuming. Many factors can interfere with toileting. A PSW may not be able to find a partner to assist with a physical transfer. Caring for several other residents in the morning, having to get them up and ready for breakfast for 8:30 sharp, the PSW may not consider it safe to leave a resident alone on the toilet while she cares for others. If a resident needs to go in the middle of a meal, again, a PSW caring for several other residents at the same time simply may not be able to leave those residents to toilet one person. And so the resident is told to use the brief, the incontinent product, you could call it a diaper if you will, that she is wearing, to use it this time, and the next time, and the next time. And over time, the resident becomes incontinent, which carries with it physical risks of skin breakdown and bladder infection, and psychological risks of depression, frustration, and isolation. Similarly, mobility can be lost as it is easier, and I use that term not as a lazy kind of thing, but really as a triage decision. It is easier to wheel a resident to a destination than to wait for her to get there on her own, given the time pressures that PSWs must deal with, and the other residents who are always waiting for care. Time pressures can also lead to risk of verbal and physical assaults. There is the danger of elder abuse when residents appear to frustrate staff attempts to get their work done, to get their bath done, the feeding. Anxiety and frustration felt by staff, impatience. These can lead to increased anxiety in residents, particularly in residents suffering from dementia. And this, in turn, results in behaviors that staff may regard as non-compliant. It is a situation that can escalate as staff members and residents experience increasing anxiety and frustration. And in long-term care, abuse directed at staff is common. Verbal abuse, physical assaults, sexual and racial slurs. These are almost considered to be a part of the job. Finally, in the long-term care setting, there is a sense of powerlessness on both sides, with residents who are unable to care for themselves being confined to a life of systemic neglect, while PSWs stand by helpless because of inhumane workloads and working conditions that give priority to tasks rather than to residents. As one PSW said, "I would like to be able to provide care that I feel good about. I feel terrible that I've cut this corner and done that. I'd like to be able to take care of somebody and feel proud. You know, when you give them a nice bath and they smell like nice, you put lotion on them, they're clean, their toenails are cut, you're proud. And other times, it's like residents don't smell nice. You're worried about this and that. The chair is soiled because you're putting pads on them, and it's just rushed care that you can't be proud of. I want to be able to take care of somebody in a way that I'm proud of my job." When we confront the issue, the reality of legalized, medically induced death, yes, we must ensure that healthcare professionals are protected from having to engage in acts that are against their consciences, and this includes providing referrals. We must do what we can to make good palliative care available to patients who are dying. But it is here in long-term care where people may believe that they would be better off dead. It's here that we need to be building a culture of life. And how exactly do we do this? Obviously, building a culture of life in long-term care means valuing the residents and the people who care for them by funding long-term care properly. When we have our discussion following this talk, I will say more about this. But it's imperative that money be provided to train and hire more staff to ensure optimal resident-staff ratios. As one PSW put it, she's dealing with people, not cardboard boxes. Building a culture of life in long-term care means being resident or patient-centered rather than task or money-centered in this sector, even when the homes are for-profit. It means setting benchmarks not about efficiencies or quantity of care, but quality of care. And understanding that care does not mean attending solely to basic physical needs in a minimal way, but seeing the patient or resident as a person and taking a holistic approach to patient care, attending to the psychosocial needs of the resident as well as to her physical needs and seeing this as worthwhile. It means valuing personal care and seeing it as very skilled and valuable labor and as multidimensional. Most important is valuing and encouraging the relationship that can develop between residents and caregivers and providing space for this, for the love and regard that can be possible between the person cared for and the person providing the care. There are many instances in which the caregivers are the only people that the residents see. They do not all have family visiting them. This is the locus of healing, in the conversation, in the touch, in the presence of the caregiver and the receiver of care, in this quiet, unrushed space. It is important to see this as deeply important to the patient and to the patient or the resident's well-being and care. And finally, we have to confront our own fears and prejudices when we are face-to-face with infirmity, age, frailty, and dementia. And here we have the lesson of Jesus and the healing of the young man who was possessed by demons. In this story found in Mark 5, 1-20 and Luke 8, 26-39, we have a young man who was possessed by demons, absolutely overtaken by them. His community was terrified by this young man and what had become of him. The only thing they could do was tie him up, chain him to a tree. This is how they cared for him, and perhaps protected themselves from the fear that he engendered in them. They isolated him and they tied him up. But he broke free and he was roaming and ranting among the tombs, and this is where Jesus encountered him, in this remote, unclean place. And Jesus was not terrified. Furthermore, he was able to distinguish between the vulnerable young man and the afflictions that assailed him. He could see beyond the terrifying demons to the young man himself. Jesus cast these demons out, and when the townsfolk came back to see what had happened, they found Jesus and the young man sitting calmly in conversation. And at this point, we could say that in some ways, it's hard for us to look at long-term care because of our own fears. Our fears of infirmity, of aging, of becoming frail, of having our minds and bodies not be what they used to be. Many, many people, as I say, find it very difficult even to step into a long-term care facility. It can be an uncomfortable place, and it can be difficult to be with residents. They remind us too much of our own human frailty and perhaps our own futures. But with the story of the young man possessed by demons, we see that Jesus was unafraid. He sees past the afflictions to the person and to that person's wholeness and value. And you might, if you want to, even say that in healing this person, Jesus shows us what we are all ultimately called to, which is wholeness, no matter what afflictions we may have suffered in this life. But if we return to the story, a very funny thing happens at the end. The young man, who is healed and joyful, asks Jesus if he can go with him and his disciples. And Jesus says, no, that is not his calling. His calling instead is to stay in his community and to glorify God there, to glorify God exactly where he is. And I think that this is the lesson for us, the thing that we have to proclaim, which is the value and worth and dignity of those residents of long-term care facilities who, in their frailty and infirmity, glorify God exactly as they are, exactly where they are, and to treat them and care for them as having that dignity, value, and worth. And this is what it is to build a culture of life in the shadow of death. Thank you. Any questions?
I think that was just brilliant.
Well, thank
from
you.
From coming from working in surgery and, mm-hmm. and then I transferred out of an OR because yes. I didn't appreciate what was happening in the OR to a long-term care center. I never worked in long-term
so
care.
So you worked in long-term care?
I did. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe how you've covered the whole gamut. Wonderful.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. Yes.
Are you going to be able to convince politicians to?
So the question is, so what are you going to tell the politicians? Now, I've got my notes all over the place. Can you give me just a minute? Because there are two things I really, really, really want to point out. Because I was thinking about this. You know how sometimes you get on the internet and you start researching things? Well, I got looking at the Sunshine List, and so this is, these figures are 2012, okay? And I got looking at a particular health network, a rather large one, and I thought to myself, how much money is spent on administration, okay? And I decided just to look at one section, and that was vice presidents, okay? So I just thought I would limit my search to vice presidents. Now, this particular network has 15 vice presidents. The highest pay is about $452,000 annually. Lowest is $120,000 annually. Interestingly, the two highest paid are men, two lowest paid are women, but I'm sure that's got nothing to do with that. With the total salary of just over $4 million for the vice presidents. Now, so the average salary is about $268,000 annually. So I got my calculator out. And so with that average salary, and not taking vacation time into account, in other words, working with 52 weeks, the average weekly salary would be $5,152.32, which translates into $128 per hour. Now, if you add some vacation time, okay, like let's say 6 weeks, we'll be conservative, the worked hourly wage is $145 per hour, okay? And this doesn't include benefits. Now, the big news for the PSWs is that as of April 2016, they are going to have their minimum wage raised to $16.50 an hour. What is it that we value? And in my opinion, there is nothing more important that we can do than care for another person. That's the most important thing that we can ever do. And yet this is the thing that is considered unskilled and will give you $16.50 for it per hour.
And no benefits.
And
you're lucky too.
And the thing that also doesn't come through here is that even when you have some kind of staff-patient ratio going, what happens with PSWs is they often work short-staffed. And they do not bring in extra help, okay? Now, you say to yourself, well, goodness gracious, can how can this be? What are you expecting? But as we read in the Globe and Mail recently, we see that there have been long-term care homes that have dipped into their residents' trust funds in order to meet the payroll. Now, I would consider that to be a criminal offense, okay? That would be a criminal offense in my books. So, as I say, we have a very vulnerable patient population in a rather unregulated way, and with unregulated workers, and workers who wish to be treated with respect, to be learning the skills, to have their skills valued. Okay? How do we convince the politicians? Well, as I say, here's what we're paying vice presidents, here's what we're paying PSWs. Are you really trying to tell me that there's no money in the healthcare system? It's how we're spending it, and it's where we are putting our priorities. And we can tell where we're putting the priorities by the money that's spent on it. And long-term care is underfunded. Period. Yes?
Rachel, what you're saying about TSWs, et cetera, is obviously a justice issue.
Yes, it is.
And it's an issue that I know you're passionate about, mm-hmm. and I know it exists whether or not there's, mm-hmm. and dying. It's an issue that has to be dealt with mm-hmm. anyway in yes. justice. I certainly agree with that. Mm-hmm. So could you maybe sort of link, if it's possible mm-hmm. to do that, this particular circumstances of people in long-term care with the legislation,
okay.
in terms of how they are now more vulnerable.
Yes. I hadn't even thought about that, but as Dr. McQueen is pointing out, when we're looking at this vulnerable patient population, in light of the new legislation, it is possible that they become even more vulnerable than they already are. Because as I said, I do not see how it is possible, given the logic that, if you want to call it that, that is driving physician-assisted death, okay? Physician-assisted suicide, medically induced death. Given this logic, I do not see how it is possible to confine intervention, if you want to call it, to people who can consent to it. Eventually, it's going to be moving out to people who cannot consent to it. And if we're looking at this patient population and seeing how clearly vulnerable is the word that just keeps coming up. I'm going to say discriminated against. Again, like if we go back to the idea of using a trust fund, okay, which really should be a criminal thing, but because it happened in a long-term care home, somehow it isn't being treated that way, even though these are very vulnerable individuals, okay? So already they are so marginalized, it is quite possible that you will have people come in and say, oh my goodness, here's so-and-so, he suffers from Alzheimer's, he suffers from dementia. What value does this life have? Surely he is in intractable pain, okay? And I'm not saying that I would look at it that way, not at all. But there could be those who project onto it and say, surely they would be better off dead. And you know what? I don't think that the caregivers would ever say that. From what I am reading, okay? But people from the outside. Yeah, do you want to add to that?
Just a couple of things. My name is Anita Miller, and I work and educate in long-term care homes. And certainly, I have a major concern with respect to the actual schools and the education that the PSWs are attending, because I feel that in many situations, the clinical supervision isn't there. And what happens is the PSWs are left to mentor new staff, and it just goes on and on. So one thing with respect to the workload would be that let's look at how are we educating them.
I'm just going to repeat that, okay, for people who may not have heard. So what you're pointing out is your concern about the education that PSWs may or may not be receiving, the fact that it is not standardized, that one doesn't have like standard sort of clinical overseeing, and that you sometimes end up with persons mentoring who may not be qualified to mentor.
And the workload is too heavy to be properly mentoring.
Yes, and as you're pointing out with the workload, how does one mentor and carry on one's work? So I just wanted to repeat that.
And the clinical instructors may be absent. So
yes.
Secondly, then we're looking at the population as well, and you know, with group homes, community homes, parents are aging. You know, you've mentioned, you know, that the profile of the actual residents coming into long-term care is changing. So we have younger people coming in, and we do have programs and activities, so quality of life if they care to join, but we can't force them because resident rights is that they can refuse. But it's really looking at that whole quality of life. And so what that means to the individual, I think generally in long-term care, the PSWs have the right intentions, and this is an ethical environment here, so the intentions are there, but again, it's workload. So it's the training, the education, and then also the budget, so that if our people are ill, that there are staff called in. And just
I'm going to stop there again. I just want to repeat what you're saying again, because you just to try to make sure everybody hears this, right? So what you're pointing out is that not only do we have residents who are coming in with heavier care needs, but you're talking about a diversity of residents as well, because you're talking about community homes, you're talking about younger people coming into long-term care, and again, raising questions about the adequacy of the education that PSWs are getting.
And then the Law Society of Ontario is looking into that whole world, the legalities of certainly a consent, informed consent, and that the resident, the substitute decision maker is not overstepping their bounds, because that's where I would be concerned with respect to euthanasia and withholding treatment, if in fact the substitute decision maker was making decisions that really were contrary to the physician and the nursing staff.
Yes, so again, bringing up the idea that one of the challenges in long-term care is around consent and substitute decision-making, and ensuring, as you're saying, the Law Society, making sure that substitute decision-makers are working within their necessary boundaries.
That the physicians are able to give a treatment plan. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So really working with understanding the role of the substitute decision maker and how care plans and decisions are made, yes. And so this becomes a huge ethical issue as well. Yeah, thank you very much. Yes. I beg your pardon. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bridget, for this presentation focusing on the long-term care facility. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But I think we have to remember, first of all, there are some long-term facilities which are extremely well-run.
Yes.
But your points are well taken, but a lot more has to be done. Mm-hmm. However, you've focused on doing that, mm-hmm. not on that this is only one aspect mm-hmm. of the healthcare system, and a lot more could be done on decreasing the need mm-hmm. for people to go into long-term care. Now, if there's more in the way of rehabilitation, so people don't deteriorate, so they need to go in, and most importantly, if there's more support in the communities, and you quoted living longer, living well,
yes.
And that again quoted some other jurisdictions, and in particular, we can take the example of Denmark, where they have decreased the need for developing more long-term care beds because they've been able to keep people in the community. Mm-hmm. And most people, of course, would much prefer to stay in their own homes. And if you throw enough resources at it, you can keep anyone in their own homes. Now, this isn't practical in many cases, but you can do a lot much mm-hmm. more in the way of keeping people in their homes. Mm-hmm. So I think that is an important point when we're talking about. And Canada's always had a reputation of warehousing the elderly. Back mm-hmm. even to the 60s, the response mm-hmm. to people was to put them in institutions, and we put people in prisons and in more than other places. Mr. Harper, that may increase. But, if we can focus on the community and the resources there, that will decrease the need for long-term care. Mm-hmm. But your point's well taken. We have to improve the long-term care we have, and in particular provide the resources for the increasing complexity of these cases. Mm-hmm. Talking about the Supreme Court decision, mm-hmm. you mentioned that physician-assisted suicide. Yeah. But we have to remember that in Quebec, they're talking about medical aid in dying. Mm-hmm. And they passed that, and that's euthanasia, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. And the Canadian Medical Association, in talking about responding to this, is talking about medical aid in dying, mm-hmm. as well as physician-assisted suicide. So thank you for your presentation. Just some comments.
Thank you very much. And Rory, I would absolutely agree with you that most people would rather be cared for in their homes. And I decided to focus on long-term care. But what I have to say about home care is this. I know that there's certainly a push to do more caring in the home. My fear is that it is motivated by saving money, that mm-hmm. it is dollar-driven. And what happens is, we in North America do not live in extended families. So caring for someone who is infirm is usually left to one person, rather than a cluster of people. Families are often scattered in Canada. And the person who is taking care of the infirm individual may herself have infirmities and health difficulties. So, again, it's like long-term care. in order for it to be just and responsible, it does have to be funded, which is, I think, exactly what you are saying. The resources really do have to be there to say, well, you'll get 10 hours of care. Can sound like a great deal, except it leaves the person with what, 148 hours left in the week, whatever, the nights. So absolutely home care, but it has to be funded. Again, a Globe and Mail article, March 13th, they were just talking about, you know, the report is a vindication for the patients and caregivers who have called or visited this person's office to just cry and cry and cry about their struggles with the system. That's not right. That's not right. Okay? But, so, again, just an area where we have to keep working. Yes, Linda.
Thank you, Bridget. I think, if I heard you correctly, you said that you kind of believe that the bill came about because there's going to be even more numbers in these long-term...
No, not necessarily.
What I'd like you to do is just say a little bit more about people that are suffering intractable suffering. Mm-hmm. And what do we do for them?
Well, you know what? Okay, so the question is, what do we do for people who are in intractable suffering? Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, I think we have some expertise in this room. Because I'm nearly an ethicist. And I would ask if there is anybody here who would like to, as a physician perhaps, address the question of intractable pain. Because sometimes I hear that all pain can be taken care of, and sometimes I hear that it can't.
Yeah. I'm Pablo Cano, I'm a palliative care physician and oncologist in Sudbury, involved with the medical school. One of our efforts now is to try to integrate and intensify education in palliative care across the spectrum, not just physicians, nurses, PAWs, volunteers, pastoral workers.
Actually, do you want to stand up and talk just a bit? Because I'm never going to be able to repeat all
that. We know that they estimate that about 30% of patients, Canadians who need palliative care are not receiving it. Well, they are receiving it very fragmented.
Palliative care means you're going to die within the year?
Palliative. Yeah, you could say that. That's the
terminal within the year.
Yeah, that's a reasonable position. The term palliative care doesn't necessarily mean that you're immediately dying in a few days. That's an extensive thing. If only 30% are receiving appropriate palliative care, that means that there's a significant amount of work to be done in terms of extending education and also convincing the government to fund it better, you know. Talking about social justice, another good bit of information came night before last when a combined study, Canadian study, revealed that if the government could gather up their efforts, the price of medication could be substantially reduced,
right,
and there could be universal coverage of all medications for all Canadians. They estimated that, for instance, if bulk purchasing by the government, you know, they could actually save close to $3 or $4 billion.
I was going to say the government gets a membership at Costco or something.
You know, $4 billion that could be destined to, you know, other important. All these issues have been considered, and the palliative care community in general across the country is making an effort to re-intensify, because I think the best answer to somebody who is desperate with pain and suffering is to provide the best relief that you can, not only physical, spiritual, you know, support.
Thank you very much. Does that help a little bit?
A little bit, but I work in a hospital that does have a wonderful palliative care unit, and I can remember a woman who was dying from a terminal vascular disease, in terrible pain, screaming with the pain. She was on a surgical ward as opposed to the palliative care unit because there weren't beds available.
Right.
And although we have a wonderful palliative team who had ordered these wonderful doses of morphine for her, the nurses on that surgical floor were very resistant in giving her those high doses of morphine.
Right.
So this is a hospital with a palliative care unit and a palliative care team that goes around the hospital. So, and that's just one experience. You know, I know there are people in this pain, and I'm wondering if, and I'm a Catholic as well, if our Catholic ethics that says thou shalt not kill, I'm wondering if when we make circumstances, you know, different compassionate circumstances like in self-defense or just war, maybe there are the odd compassionate circumstances in this case for people who can't get the palliative care that they need.
Yeah, so this is certainly one point of view. I will tell you that the Catholic teaching, there are no loopholes on this one, you know. But again, what Dr. here is saying, and the case that you are bringing up, I have a friend who works in palliative care in Coburg, and she designed a manual that's to be used throughout the hospital, because, as you're saying, and as you're pointing out, palliative care, people die everywhere. And palliative care is not confined to palliative care units. Yeah.
But and the nurses, you see, aren't used to those high doses.
No, they aren't. No, they aren't.
So they won't give them.
Well, not yet. More education is absolutely needed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oops. Okay. Now there were other hands up, and I wanted so here and here. Yes.
Just wondering, don't people in power realize that they're setting themselves up with these standards for themselves and their own loved ones in the future?
So, as you're pointing out, like, it doesn't the government realize what they're doing, that they're setting these standards not simply for themselves, but their own loved ones in the future, so that if we're having this neglect of, say, home care, community care, lack of education and palliative care, this is something, remember, most legislation, I'm going to go out on a limb here, is made by people who are well. You know?
I ask that question because I'm well too.
Yes.
But I know that I'm not going to be well all my life.
Yes.
I will be old and I will be.
Yeah, except it may be hard for us to see that. Yeah. No, sometimes you say, what is going on? Why are you not thinking ahead?
They aren't as well, they have money.
And while there's the money, yes, it's the money. Yes, it's probably.
I'm having a senior's moment. I've forgotten his name. Mm-hmm. He was the chief medical doctor in the SARS mess. He gave a 10-minute presentation before he died. Lucid, doctor, articulate, a beautiful wife standing beside him. I'm not sure it's driven by the politicians. Yeah. I think, how would you speak to Dr. Lowe? What would convince Dr. Lowe? Because more than anything else, as soon as I saw that, I said, the game is over at this level now. Yeah. Because that is, I mean, he was well, beautiful home, setting, everything, all the cards are on his side. He said, I wanted to stop in this articulate wife, and boom. And I think that represents, to my mind, where's the culture touch into that?
Yes, I take your point. Sometimes you have to let some things go. And what I mean to say is, there's Dr. Lowe, and there's his video, and there it is. And it's important not to get distracted by things like that. How to put this? With this presentation, what I was thinking about was, okay, forget all the static. What is it that we need to do, what is one of the things that we need to do? As far as I'm concerned, it's absolutely essential that we have reform where it comes to caring for our most vulnerable population. Okay, and whether this happens in the home or in a long-term care facility, it doesn't matter. We need to have reform, and if we focus on that, it doesn't matter what Dr. Lowe does. It doesn't matter what the Hemlock Society does. In a way, and I don't mean to sound heretical here, doesn't matter what the legislation is. We stick to our business. And our business is building a culture of life.
Who's
and we
the
don't,
we, please?
Pardon?
Doctor, who's the we?
The we
who
is
this
doctor?
We?
The we is the guy I brought communion to every day until he was 94.
Yeah.
And he bumped his head while he was going to the bathroom on the toilet. And they put him in a long-term care facility. Mm-hmm. And he called me up crying, saying mm-hmm. he wanted to go back home, mm-hmm. that he couldn't take it there. So I went and visited him there a couple times.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go back.
Well,
stinky.
Well,
terrible.
Yeah. Well, so, well, who is the we? Who are the we?
Well, you gave us the numbers, didn't you? It's a license to print money and...
But I think that what you're asking is who are the we who is building a culture of life? Is that the question?
And steal their money and kill
them. Who's this we who's going to do all of this?
You're
not going to convince
it doesn't,
the politicians.
It doesn't, that doesn't matter. Okay, now, like, there may be people who are really called to do that kind of thing, but as far as I'm concerned, that's status. Okay? What I think about are the Sisters of St. Joseph. Okay? Now, and I'll tell you what I think about when I think about the Sisters of St. Joseph. I think about them starting St. Michael's Hospital, okay, back in the 1800s, okay? And so you have this very small group of women who come over from France, for heaven's sakes, they go up, you know, the Mississippi River, they land at St. Louis, they make their way to Toronto, which is probably York. And in Toronto, I've told you this story before. Okay, in Toronto, you have this large Irish population that is extremely marginalized, okay? They can't get work, they can't get housing, they cannot get health care. And so the sisters work among the Irish, and that's what they do. They go into their homes and they take care of them. And then, of course, there's the cholera outbreak or typhus or something. And the sisters, again, they go about their business, and their business is caring for this marginalized population. And at the end of the epidemic, the chief medical officer of health in the city of Toronto, who is probably not an Irish Catholic, or even favorably disposed towards Irish Catholics, is so impressed by their work that he says, please, build us a hospital. And that's what they did. And they had, what, like 10 beds to begin with? How did they get the money for it? They begged. They did laundry. They prayed. I think about, you know, the sisters on the West Coast going into the logging camps and selling subscriptions to their hospital for like $1 a year, a person could get care at their hospital. It sounds like health insurance to me, okay? But they're going alone in the woods. This is courage. This is faith. Sometimes you don't ask how the thing is going to get done, you just do it. And so we end up having St. Michael's Hospital standing as a witness to the healing ministry of Christ. That's what it is. And I wish that we could still have Catholic health care right now that was directed towards long-term care. I don't know that that is possible. I don't know. But when we talk about building a culture of life, it may mean bringing these issues forward for some people. It may mean bringing the absurdity of our health care system forward. It may mean visiting somebody in a long-term care institution. It may mean volunteering. You know, it could mean a whole bunch of different things. What would you like to say?
Imagine if we all wrote letters to our MPs,
mm-hmm.
or MPPs.
Yeah.
You know, if we all crowded mm-hmm. their mailboxes, mm-hmm. their emails, and got engaged politically.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So it could take people walking the talk. It could take writing the letters.
You see, like, there are different, people are called to witness in different ways. And the point, and so that you could be quite right about that, the point I'm making is, as well, is imagine. Like, I've actually been, there was a very good long-term care institution that I was in, and it was interesting, because the staff said there that they wished that, you know, if they had to become infirm, that they hoped that they would get dementia, because then they would be able to be cared for in this institution. Normally, staff say, I would, well, never mind. Like, they don't want to be in there. But this was a wonderful long-term care institution. It was life-giving. It was community building. If we have that, if we have good home care, if we have support, then maybe it doesn't matter what the legislation says. What would happen if there was suddenly no demand for physician-assisted death? Okay? Yeah.
I'm just going to say, so this affects certainly across the continuum. Like it's acute care,
yep.
it's neonatal care,
yep.
it's pediatric care,
mm-hmm.
all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly vulnerable at midlife
mm-hmm.
if they're dependent or later in life. But with this legislation
mm-hmm.
and decisions and substitute decision makers saying, even though the doctor recommends, you know,
mm-hmm.
treatment,
mm-hmm.
it very, very scary and,
mm-hmm.
and very morally distressing
mm-hmm.
for all departments, I would say,
yeah.
in acute as well as in long-term
mm-hmm.
care.
Yes.
That's
people have to understand what their role is as a substitute decision maker, I think, which is
right.
one of the things that you were pointing
out. And the physicians be elevated to
mm-hmm.
be able to work within
mm-hmm.
that treatment plan
That's
and
exactly
give the
right.
options.
That's right. The substitute decision makers
and work with ethicists and have it documented.
Yeah. You know, so, yes.
Yeah. Yes, another piece of information. I attended a McGill conference for a follow-up about the Oregon experience.
Oh, yes, the
Oregon is the
yes.
first state legislating,
mm-hmm.
and so far it's 15, 16 years.
Yeah.
About 700 people
oh,
have been,
mm-hmm.
I would say committed,
they've
have
this
yeah. and you don't call it suicide, it's called the Death with Dignity
oh,
Act
so okay.
in Oregon.
Okay.
However, there's a lot of interesting facts that have been noted afterwards.
Okay.
First of all, the follow-up of what happened with this family has been negligible research into it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was also learned that a good number of, I don't know the exact percentage,
mm-hmm.
maybe the 25-30%, patients who got the prescription from the physicians,
mm-hmm.
but never actually decided not to use it.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's another important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that in many cases, they found that the physicians, because you need the agreement of two physicians
mm-hmm.
to sign the okay, actually some of these were not their patient regular physician.
They
sometimes
were not,
it was
they
a single,
were not the regular physician.
Yeah,
physician
sometimes
for the patient.
It was a single visit, you know, a very, very, you know,
so the stranger, so a physician who is a stranger ends up signing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's an important
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
that's something that should give us some pause
mm-hmm.
to it, you know.
Yeah.
And about the fact that in some cases the pain and suffering could be, you know, in my 35 years experience, I had 3 patients who needed to actually be given anesthetic because that was the only way to relieve the pain,
mm-hmm.
you know, massive doses of morphine,
mm-hmm.
we're talking 10,000 milligrams of morphine a day would not relieve the pain,
oh, wow.
so they have to receive
yeah.
this drug called propofol, which is an ordinary anesthetic that you give in the emergency.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody comes with a broken voice,
mm-hmm.
set it, you give
mm-hmm.
put them to sleep for 10 minutes and you fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's the drug that killed Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Yeah. In those 3 patients, actually, the pain was finally relieved,
mm-hmm.
the family was relax,
yeah.
and the patient died within, you know, 24 to 48 hours, but the intention was not
no.
kill,
yeah.
but
yeah.
really
yeah.
the pain.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Just two comments. I guess I've had some personal involvement, either at the governance level or as a caregiver, with various long-term care institutions. And I've certainly been impressed, for instance, with Providence
yes.
here.
Yes.
And I've been very impressed with Toronto Grace, which is Salvation
yes.
Army.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree.
There's
yes.
a certain spirit that
mm-hmm.
permeates
yes.
mm-hmm. those institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So one point I'd like to make is the Catholic Health Corporation of Ontario, which is the sponsor group for, I think, 12 or 15 hospitals, including the 3 here in Toronto,
oh.
St. Joe's, St. Mike's, and Providence.
Yes.
I think it's looking for a better focus.
Yeah.
Right now it's sponsorship, but that's a little bit nebulous.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that that would be a place where you could go and make the case.
I would love to, yes.
Because I think that
mm-hmm.
they'd be quite open
mm-hmm.
to providing that kind of support for their institutions.
Well, there you are.
So that would be one focal point. The other thing is just an anecdote, and that was I was on the board at one time of the Bloorview Children's Hospital.
Yes.
And at the time of the Latimer case, this wasn't assisted suicide, this was murder.
That was a mercy.
But I've never seen a more upset group of patients, parents, board members, than at that case. They felt that this was out and out murder. There was no sympathy whatsoever for, you know, anyone taking anyone's life, and they valued the life of their children who had multiple disabilities.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And thank you very much for that. Yes, thank you. And you had your hand up.
Well, I was going to follow up with a study that looked into the Oregon case. Another statistic was that the requests for physician assisted went down. Mm-hmm. There wasn't an increase in requests. So I think that's often what we hear.
Oh, interesting.
Is that if it's available, more people will be asking for it.
Right.
So, and also, I've heard some statistics as well about that Oregon case that they've studied, that there hasn't been a slippery slope in Oregon.
Okay.
So I think that's a legitimate, you know, fear.
Right.
But I know some who have looked into what's happened in Oregon, and that's been there long enough, but they really haven't seen the slippery slope.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we can still have a lot of influence, you know, as faith-based people on what happens out there. I don't think the fear, you know, what could happen, I think, if we focus on that, whereas we say, well, now what we can do? What we can do as a Catholic organization.
That's
what can we do as nurses who work in nurses who have a faith, working in institutions, and as a nurse, the profession itself is looking at this, and the palliative care nurses are very concerned. But my sense is that you know, the more we talk about where we are, we're coming from, that should be open enough that there is a choice for people who, you know, maybe like Dr. Lowe, but there's also we can have an influence as well as our faith-based group on what's going to happen in the future, I hope.
I don't think so. what happened with the abortion issues?
Yeah.
The same thing's going to happen, like the professor said. The Pandora's box has been opened.
Well, and as I say, like I'm interested to find out more about the Oregon thing, because what I've done more of my research on is the Netherlands, and there really was, as you know, it really disintegrated there. So yeah. And did you?
My name is Marisa Zerzito. I'm a geriatrician, and I am at St. Michael's Hospital, and I teach a lot of medical students and come in contact with a lot of residents and that are in training. So this case comes up, the Supreme Court decision comes up, and we sort of fuddle and we talk. Mm-hmm. And I say, what do you think about this? Do you think about the slippery slope? And they say, that's not what happened in Holland. It's not what happened in Belgium. It's not what happened in Switzerland. Not what happened in Oregon. And besides, the numbers are very small. Most people don't opt for this.
Right.
I said, but what about, you know, your Hippocratic Oath? The fact that you said, you know, you swore that you wouldn't take life.
You wouldn't actually kill people.
You wouldn't take life, but you wouldn't do this. That, you know, well, how is this going to change your relationship with the public and the trust that you have with the public, the covenant that you have signed on to here? And they say, just another armamentarium in my bag, that when people ask me, you know, I'm really suffering, and it doesn't have to be pain. It can be existential suffering, like the individual who actually went to Dr. Kevorkian.
Yes.
She wasn't in pain.
No,
she was existentially suffering about what could happen to her in the future. I mean, she could have been hit by a bus tomorrow, but that's irrelevant, okay? And there obviously was no meaning for her in that path of suffering or anything else. It had no meaning for her, and she presumed it had no meaning for anybody else.
Yes, and I think
that's what she presumed.
Well, and plus, as you're saying, it can be fear-driven.
Well, it might be fear-driven, but, you know, I mean, this is death with dignity, and then there is the fellow who goes on TV Ontario on the Doc series, and he's perfectly well. He's just getting older. And he says he doesn't want the indignities of old age. And he says that he has stockpiled whatever. Mm-hmm. He was with the Death with Dignity Society. Mm-hmm. He has stockpiled his whatever, pills, one thing and another. And one day he tells his son, today is the day we're going to have my celebration. We're all going to have my living wake. And the following day, he died. Now, he had no terminal illness and no suffering and nothing else. But his son, who clearly had a relationship with him, says, I don't agree with this. I don't agree with this. But, you know, it's his wish and it is his life.
Right. But what you're pointing out is this, and danger is the wrong word, but the way we are wedded to autonomy, the idea that somehow we are self-sufficient, self-governing, and so on.
It's not our body, it's God's body.
Well, it isn't even just that. If we think of ourselves possibly as being made in the image and likeness of God, there's a sense that God is Trinitarian. Individual living in community, constantly giving and taking, this reciprocal love, okay? We are not islands. Anybody who drives the 401 knows this. You know, somebody stops, you have to react. I mean, like, it's just we are connected, well, sometimes more than others, to each other. So that the action of one person in taking his life can affect others. The son, for instance, Janet Atkins' sons did not agree with her decision. We don't know what might be going on in their minds, if they thought, well, maybe if we had promised to care for her or had done more or whatever, we could have stopped this. And as you were pointing out, particularly when it comes to medically induced death, you have someone deliberately supplying the means or actually doing the action that kills the patient. We become what we do. If you kill people, you become a killer. You can talk about covenants, you know, and trust. And what does it mean to be a physician or a healthcare professional? What does this mean? Our actions matter. So we have to take that. We are not purely autonomous beings. And thankfully, we are not purely autonomous beings.
On that note, when you mentioned that, made me think of, I believe it's John Howard Griffin who said that, is the only way for good to conquer evil is for good men and women in the beloved to do good over and over and over.
So you're quoting John Howard Griffin who says that, you know, if we are to overcome evil, it means that good people must keep doing good and doing good and doing good and reflecting on what it means to do good and what we are called to be. And I think, Boyer, how is our timing doing here?
We have a couple minutes.
Okay, so I don't know if there are any more comments or questions. Have I missed anybody? Yes.
I think that here, talk about the autonomy versus, you know, connectedness and consequences. I think you touch on something very central, not just in this issue, but in many others. And I think there's a need for consistency across the board. Sometimes we can argue the connectedness and consequences in this area, but be very kind of radical autonomous in other areas. So I'm thinking things like the economy or the environment, you know, because we think that if we fall on a certain part of the spectrum, we have to kind of fall lockstep into certain, you know, ideas. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that maybe what you are describing are the demands of a life ethic. You know, which means that we don't confine it just to one area. You know, certainly my interest is in healthcare and healthcare ethics, but you're also pointing out the environment and our responsibility there. Social justice issues, we are connected. And I think that this, in my opinion, if we're talking about healthcare ethics, the principle of respect for patient autonomy has been the driving principle probably from the 1970s onwards, okay? And this is where we come into issues like informed consent, for instance, substitute decision-making, confidentiality. The patient is actually being a partner in treatment decisions. And this was kind of a new concept in 1970. And so this has been kind of a driving force. And in my opinion, as we are becoming more aware of ourselves as living within a globalized context, and for me, the kicker was the epiphany came when I took a look at AIDS and the effect of AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. AIDS in North America is very much about respect for patient autonomy as we worry about confidentiality issues and so on and so forth. But you move to sub-Saharan Africa, where AIDS is a different thing, we'll do a whole other story on this another time. The fact is that I believe that the 21st century, at least at the beginning of it, who knows what will come, the driving principle now ought to be justice. And justice means connection, and know that we are connected. So that's how I would respond to that. And anyone else?
This may be too simple,
well, it's never
but
too
if
simple.
We in civilization created, we can destroy.
Yeah.
But we did not create.
No, we did not create. And we are creatures. And because we are creatures, this gives us profound dignity, because there is a way in which we are always connected to the Creator. Okay? That's what it means to be a creature. So we are always, always connected to the rest of creation and to our Creator in a very profound way. There's nothing simple about that at all. Okay. And may I thank you very much for your questions and especially for your comments, because as I drive back to Coburg, I hope not becoming too connected to anybody on my way home, I will be thinking very much about the comments that you raised, and because it helps me develop my own thinking, so I thank you very much for that.
Bridget, thank you so much for raising all those particular topics. It's a vast area, and I must just say that it is such a vast area that it definitely needs more discussion. So I think we've talked about these issues before, but in light of the Supreme Court decision again, with the different cast that makes, we'll need to plan another event. I'd just like to add that I'm on a slightly different trajectory myself, just about the Supreme Court decision, yeah. Not about anything else you said. I'm not even disagreeing with you, but I'm just thinking a different way. That so many groups are being asked to consider how we can help to make the safeguards. There's a foregone conclusion that this is going to be law, that the Supreme Court can tell Parliament, you have to do this, that Parliament must do it. Between, and they're saying a year, which is not going to happen, Parliament can always ask for extra time. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion necessarily. I also think that working with people to be very careful, as the CMA is saying, to provide these safeguards. We know that in Holland, for example, your slippery slope arguments, every single criterion was washed away in 3 or 4 years. So we can lull ourselves, I think, into a somewhat false sense of security, I think, in thinking that we can really at least get in here and make sure that it's limited.
So
I'm wondering if that's really a worthwhile venture at this point. I'm not talking about us, but in general for people. I think there's a possibility of constitutional challenges, for sure,
right.
The Supreme Court vis-a-vis Parliament itself. There is the invocation of the notwithstanding clause, which, of course, the present government is saying they have no interest in following, but it depends. It's, I think, worth another political pursuit. I think what I'm saying right now is that I don't want to just sort of say, okay, the deal is done, and we will do this, and we'll see how it happens. I'm saying I think there's still some fight in us,
okay.
Because we have some reasons for the fight, and I very much don't think it's hopeless. One part of me, I have to be honest, does, just as the way none of us here wanted, I'm assuming, the Supreme Court decision, and we hoped against hope it wouldn't happen, and we worked to make sure it didn't happen, and it did happen, and you're just, oh gosh, here we go. But does that mean that we just sort of say, okay, it's happened, it's inevitable, and all the rest of it? I think perhaps there's a few things we can do. There's a constitutional challenge going to be launched next week by the Christian Medical and Dental Association, the Catholic Physicians Guild, the Canadian Catholic Physicians Guild. They're looking for other supporters about the conscience clause. So they're sort of saying, look, there's other things we can do, and I'm hoping we could maybe develop some of those aspects as well as your very well-researched talk tonight, and I think you're a real inspiration to us to make us realize that at the personal level, as well as at the social and political level, there's a lot we could do in these very specific areas that are all part of that bigger picture. Perfect. So thank you very much.